In the early 1960s, a gruesome string of murders terrified the greater Boston area. One after another, single women were being raped and murdered, leaving police mystified and much of the city afraid to go out after dark. A state task force was set up to hunt for a killer who became known as the Boston Strangler.
Before the year 1963 rang in, there were 8 women dead in 6 months. In the greater area of Boston, no woman alone was safe.
That's the voice of filmmaker Miles Jewell, who reminds us that by 1964, 13 women were dead. His new movie, Stranglehold, in the shadow of the Boston Strangler, is showing tonight as part of the Boston Film Festival. It tells the story of one of the most notorious unsolved criminal cases in the history of Boston, and the story of a family business and obsession.
This is the untold story of the Boston Strangler by Philip J. DiNatale.
Miles Jewell's grandfather was Boston Police Detective Phil DiNatale, who dedicated much of his career trying to crack the Boston Strangler case. Albert DeSalvo confessed to the killings, but was never tried for them and was murdered in jail. Over the years, some have doubted that DeSalvo was the Boston Strangler, but DiNatale remained convinced he was.
Sometimes to this day, people say that he isn't. For what reason, I don't know. They can say he isn't in one sentence, but I can go and produce documents after documents for days and days and show you that he is.
Phil DiNatale died in 1987, but he left behind stacks of case records, diaries, and recordings from the case that came to define his life and haunt his family. And filmmaker Miles Jewell joins me now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Anthony. Great pleasure to be here on the show.
Also joining us is John DiNatale. He's the executive producer of the film. He's also Miles' uncle and the son of Detective Phil DiNatale. He's a detective himself. Welcome to you, John DiNatale. Great to have you.
Good to be here.
So, John, tell me about growing up in this family. Your father was this very talented detective in the Boston Police Force. What was that like?
Growing up with him, I mean, I was in high school and learned how to drive and follow people at the same time. I mean, I had my learner's permit when I conducted my first surveillance case with my dad, you know, seated beside me in the front seat. So I grew up in the business as almost he did, as he used to say, you know, he and his 5 brothers, 4 of whom were Boston police officers, and numerous other cousins. So it's a generational type of thing. And when I first sat down with Miles, I said, Miles, you've got your grandfather who clearly worked on the biggest case of his generation, and we've got all of these documents here. I knew my dad, from having worked with him for many years, that he really wanted to get the story out and just was unable to do that. So with Miles's talent, I think that we've told a good story.
I think you have. And let's talk a little bit about that story. And Miles, let me come back to you, your grandfather, John's father. As we said, he was convinced that Albert DeSalvo was the killer, was the Boston Strangler. And that's because of exhaustive detective work that he did. And I want to play a clip from the film where you, Miles, sum up a crucial part of that work. That DeSalvo made statements to the police, including your grandfather, about details of the killings that only the killer could have known. Let's listen.
14 statements could only be known by seeing the crime scene photo, leaving 5 of those statements being information only the killer could know. And Albert knew this information. As all investigators will tell you, there are no coincidences.
And yet, Miles, Albert DeSalvo was never actually tried for these crimes. Remind us why not.
He was going to get locked up for rapes and breaking and enterings. He had so many charges against him that they knew that they could put him away for life on these charges. And at the time, the then Attorney General Edward Brooke was about to go up for the Senate race, and he was going to handle all the convictions. And he said, you know what? We're not going to convict him. We're going to put him away for life for the B&Es. And we know
the breaking and entering for
correct.
The lesser charges, right?
Correct. We'll put him away for life on that. And we know that the Strangler's off the streets, and people can rest assured. But, you know, for my grandfather, that was never enough. It was never going to be enough until the conviction was sought in a court of law.
And yet there have been other theories about the Boston Strangler, and you talk about these in the film, among them that Albert DeSalvo wasn't the Boston Strangler. And here's author Susan Kelly, who's in your film, talking about her 1995 book, The Boston Stranglers, plural, and she puts forth this theory.
The Boston stranglings were not serial killings committed by one man, who in this case would be Albert DeSalvo. My thesis is that they were committed by at least 8 and possibly 11 different parties.
Now, John, let me come back to you. Obviously, those kinds of theories, very frustrating for your father because he was convinced, right, that it was Albert DeSalvo. So tell us about what that did to him.
Susan Kelly's book was really the genesis of my plunging into this whole thing to kind of rectify what I thought was misinformation that was quickly becoming truth. My dad was obviously deceased at that point when Susan's book came out, or else he would have been knocking on her door. He had done so much verification of the confessions, and this is what Miles has touched upon with our story. And, of course, he used to love to say, funny thing happened when Albert DeSalvo went to jail. People stopped dying.
Yeah.
And, you know, that wasn't a coincidence.
Right.
And so I'm a private investigator. I've been doing this for 30-some-odd years. We run the oldest detective agency in the city. If you think that there were as many as 8 or 9 separate killers, then that means that all of these people have gone free and undetected, which means that every police officer in every town who investigated these cases was wrong.
John, why was it so important to make this film to you? Obviously, it's personal. It's your dad's reputation. Did you want to sort of make sure the real story about the important work that your father did got told correctly?
Oh, absolutely. And yeah. And I say, I started writing people letters, trying to get people interested to do a book, to do a story. And, you know, I just kept getting rejected and rejected until finally I convinced my nephew.
And Miles, let me come back to you. You make the point in the film that this case has been a huge presence in your family for generations, and it hasn't always been easy for folks in your family. And I want to play a clip from your film. It's from your mother, Jean, who really complains somewhat bitterly about the way this case consumed her father, your grandfather. Let's listen.
How I would have felt about things if my father was a postman. I mean, that was sort of like my big fantasy, and everybody would be talking about that. Not, you know, oh, some lady was found with her feet spread apart, with a broom handle upper. I mean, what was that about? Yeah, it's interesting, but you can't make it be a lifetime project.
So, Miles, how prevalent was that attitude in your family?
You know, certainly it was also a lot about the fear that was instilled in my mom having a father as a cop, because, you know, it was always, you're going to get your head bashed in. This is going to happen to you. You know, these types of things. And so my mom has kind of lived with this fear throughout her life because her father saw bad things going on.
And John, let me ask you about Jean. That's your sister. You're in the family business in a big way. You're a private detective. But how do you respond to that view she expressed in the film?
Well, I think it's quite natural. I see it with my two daughters. If I had a nickel for every time somebody said to me, you're not going to believe this story, and I looked at them and said, of course I will, because I've already heard it. You know, we would all retire in this room. I've seen the worst of people, and I mean, I see it on a daily basis. I've seen the worst of accidents. I see the worst of crimes. And so that trickles down to my daughters. My dad was the same way. I mean, he saw the worst of things all the time. So that kind of rolled off of my back, maybe just because of who I am. But it certainly affected my sister Evelyn, my twin sister, and my sister Jean.
Miles, at the end of the film, you pose this question, is this passion or obsession? And you ask, how do you let go of this legacy? It's a provocative question. Does the legacy haunt you? Or
you know, one thing that was really important to me, you know, especially hearing from, you know, my mom's side of things, and about that fact about, you know, just close the case, is this idea of the letting go. And for me, it was going to be, I had to finish the movie. Finishing the movie for me was the letting go. And so ultimately, that's how I wanted to end it. You know, my ability to move on would be to finish the film, get it out there, so that Phil's story could be on record and why he so strongly believes that Albert DeSalvo was the Boston Strangler.
Yeah, that allowed you to let go. What about you, John? Will you ever let go of the story that your father never could fully tell before he died?
I can feel the strings loosening up. Especially with this project, because I really think it tells a great story. And I feel that the story is going to get out there. And then I'm hoping that it then becomes not just a local one-night story for the Boston Film Festival, but it becomes a story that goes across the country. And then I'll feel like, okay, Phil, I've gotten your story out there.
Well, gentlemen, thank you both for coming in very much. Miles Jewell is a director and producer of Stranglehold in the Shadow of the Boston Strangler. John DiNatale is the executive producer and the head of DiNatale Detective Agency. The film is showing tonight at the Boston Film Festival at the Stewart Street Playhouse. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Anthony. Appreciate it.
Well, that's it for today. Tomorrow on the show, we'll take a look at Ballot Question 3, the Medical Marijuana Initiative. It's supported by the Massachusetts ACLU and the Committee for Compassionate Medicine.
It's opposed by the Mass Medical Society and the Chiefs of Police. So should Massachusetts join the 17 other states that have legalized marijuana for patient use? That's tomorrow on Radio Boston.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at boston.com. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.